Genesis 27, the 28th talk in a series in Genesis, was presented by David Crabtree on October 13, 2002 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2002. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed, in whole, for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We're looking at Genesis chapter 27 today. This is the scene where Jacob deceives his father Isaac. It's a kind of complicated scenario, and it's one of those times when we would particularly like to know what people are thinking when this happens. What are their motivations? What are they thinking? What are they trying to achieve? And yet, it is the nature of Old Testament narrative that it doesn't generally tell you those things. The best we can do is piece together from the clues. In fact, that's one of the intriguing things about the Old Testament narratives. They force you to relive the situation. They force you to imagine yourself in that position. What would you do? What do people do in these kinds of situations? What would cause them to act the way that they act? And as a result, it requires very active reading rather than passive. You can't just sit back and be told, like in a Russian novel, the reason they're 1,000 pages long is you're told every thought. Well, Old Testament narrative, you aren't told thoughts. You're just told what they did, and you have to piece together why they did what they did. The other problem in this passage is we don't know the background information. We don't know what the protocol is for the giving of blessings. We can only speculate and reconstruct to a certain degree, but we aren't told those things. We're expected to know them. So all we can do is speculate in that respect. So we're at kind of a double disadvantage in a sense in putting together the pieces. So it's kind of a puzzle, but we'll see if we can make some sense of it. Let's read the first section, the first 17 verses. Now it came about when Isaac was old, and his eyes were too dim to see, that he called his older son Esau and said to him, "My son." And he said to him, "Here I am." And Isaac said, "Behold now, I am old, and I do not know the day of my death. Now then, please take your gear, your quiver and your bow, and go out to the field and hunt game for me, and prepare a savory dish for me, such as I love, and bring it to me that I may eat, so that my soul may bless you before I die." And Rebekah was listening while Isaac spoke to his son Esau. So when Esau went to the field to hunt for game to bring home, Rebekah said to her son Jacob, "Behold, I heard your father speak to your brother Esau, saying, 'Bring me some game and prepare a savory dish for me, that I may eat and bless you in the presence of the Lord before my death.' Now, therefore, my son, listen to me as I command you. Go now to the flock and bring me two choice kids from there, that I may prepare them as a savory dish for your father, such as he loves. Then you shall bring it to your father, that he may eat, so that he may bless you before his death." And Jacob answered his mother Rebekah, "Behold, Esau my brother is a hairy man, and I am a smooth man. Perhaps my father will feel me. Then I shall be as a deceiver in his sight, and I shall bring upon myself a curse and not a blessing." But his mother said to him, "Your curse be on me, my son. Only obey my voice and go. Get them for me." So he went and got them and brought them to his mother. and his mother made savory food such as his father loved. Then Rebekah took the best garments of Esau, her elder son, which were with her in the house, and put them on Jacob, her younger son. And she put the skins of the kids on his hands and on the smooth part of his neck. She also gave the savory food and the bread which she had made to her son Jacob. Okay, so Isaac is getting old. He's about 137 years old at this point in time. His eyesight is getting dim, and he thinks that his death is near. It's not clear why he thinks that his death is near. He must be somewhat infirm. He's apparently lying down, because when Jacob brings the food in later, he has him get up and eat. So apparently he's lying down, but he's capable of getting up. His half-brother Ishmael had died at the age of 137 years old, so he had died about 14 years earlier. So it could be that Jacob is thinking, well, this is the time when my generation dies. So it may be that he's just anticipating his death. In fact, he lives another 40 years, more than 40 years past this point in time. But he thinks that his death might be close. He wants to give a blessing to his oldest son, Esau. Now, this is obviously distinct from the birthright. As we go on in the account, it's clear that the giving of the birthright and the giving of the blessing are two separate things, and they can be apparently both given to different people. And as you will recall, Jacob had conned his way into getting the birthright, and so now it's time to give the blessing, and Isaac wants to give it to Esau. Now, does Isaac know that Esau has sold the birthright? I think he must have known that, and there are two reasons that I think that. One is, the blessing does not make mention of some key things in the birthright. Presumably, the birthright includes the inheritance of the promises of numerous descendants and the land. And the blessing does not go into that. So apparently, Isaac is acknowledging that that is destined to go to Jacob. Just a second. However, the blessing that is placed on Esau does take on directly who will serve whom. And I think that what Isaac wants to do is overturn the prophecy that was given to Rebekah. If you'll recall, before the twins were born, back in chapter 25. Remember, the two babies were struggling in the womb, wrestling in the womb. And Rebekah became quite disturbed and inquired of the Lord as to what was going on. And God responded to her in verse 23 of chapter 25. And it says, two nations are in your womb, and two peoples shall be separated from your body. And one people shall be the stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger. Later on in the blessing, we'll see later in this chapter, Isaac is going to try to counter that, to make a blessing that goes counter to that prophecy. Did Isaac know the prophecy? I think it's inconceivable that he wouldn't have. Although the prophecy was given to Rebekah, this happened before the births of the children. I just can't imagine that she would not have passed that information on to her husband. But we will talk about what Isaac thinks he's doing here later. I suspect that Isaac is a little bit wary of giving this blessing to Esau. And the reason that I think he's wary is because he's not making this a public event. You would think that this would be a kind of event where you would want to have people present and it would be celebrated. And he would publicly, at least before his household, proclaim this blessing on Esau. But that's not the way it's being done. He calls in Esau by himself. He asks him to go out and prepare this dish and then come back and he will be blessed. The only element of celebration in this is that food is going to be eaten, and that seems to be common with their celebrations. But other than that, it's not a celebration. It's a very private matter. And I think that indicates some anxiety on the part of Isaac. Okay, so what he asks of Esau is that he prepare the dish that he loves. Isaac apparently likes his pleasures. He likes eating. And he wants Esau to fix this his favorite dish out of game. Remember, he likes Esau because Esau is an outdoorsman. And remember earlier, Esau sold his birthright for food. And there seems to be some compatibility between the two in that they both like their sensual pleasures. And we'll see that later. I think that becomes more pronounced later in the passage. He says that the wording here as to what he's going to do is interesting. It doesn't come out in translation very well. Let's see, I'm on the wrong page. He says, bring this dish so that my soul may bless you before I die. So my soul may bless you before I die. That phrase shows up 4 times in this passage. It seems to be significant that that's the way that it's stated. Interestingly, when Rebekah reports to Jacob what Isaac had said, she puts it differently. Notice in verse 7, she, in relating what Isaac had said, says, "And bless you in the presence of the Lord before my death." So apparently the custom, the perspective on the blessing is, this blessing is something proclaimed by Isaac, but is proclaimed in the presence of the Lord and has the Lord's stamp of approval behind it. That's what makes it happen. That's what gives it its power. But Isaac, feeling nervous about what he's doing, feeling some anxiety, realizing that to some extent he's going contrary to the wishes of God, what God had proclaimed in the prophecy, he omits that phrase in the presence of the Lord and says that my soul may bless you. Okay, so I think what we've got here is Isaac with a little bit of anxiety with respect to what he's doing, that he realizes that he is, at least to some extent, going against the wishes of God. Okay. Rebekah overheard this. What we see here is some of Rebekah's character. Rebekah hasn't been a significant character up to now, and we haven't seen much of her in action. We don't know much about her. One thing that we already know is that she's decisive. If you will recall, when the servant of Abraham was sent to get a wife for Isaac, he chose Rebekah and told Rebekah why he had come. Rebekah decides she wants to go and be the wife of Isaac. And then the servant wants to leave. But her brother doesn't want her to leave yet, wants her to hang around for a while. But the servant is insistent, we need to go now, and they decide to leave it up to Rebekah. Rebekah has to decide. And she decides immediately, I'm going now. So Rebekah is a decisive person. We've seen that already. And in this scenario, we see her acting decisively. clearly she wants her favorite, Jacob, to receive the blessing. And what she sees happening is if she does not act quickly, he's not going to get it. So this is a snap decision on her part. She has to take action. She has to enter in and make sure that the wrong thing does not happen. But we see another aspect of Rebecca that we haven't seen before, and that is she's a deceiver. She's willing to enter into subterfuge to make sure that what she wants to happen happens. Now, this we haven't seen in her before. We have seen it in Jacob. So there is a kinship between Rebecca and Jacob. They are similar in personalities, just as Isaac and Esau are similar in personalities. And that apparently accounts for why one is the favorite of the mother and the other is the favorite of the father. Now, I suspect that Rebecca sees the prophecy that had been given as justification for what she's doing. She has to take quick action to make sure that the prophecy that had been given before the birth of the twins gets fulfilled, to make sure that Jacob comes out the one on top with Esau serving him, as the prophecy had said. But the time's running out, so this is a desperate attempt to make sure that she doesn't miss out on this chance, the only chance that she has. Clearly, in this situation, Rebecca is in charge. She is the one who's decided what course of action needs to be taken. She's come up with this scheme as to how they can make sure that Jacob gets the blessing and not Esau. And she has all the plans worked out very quickly. She doesn't ask for Jacob's agreement. She just commands Jacob to do this. And her plan is, Esau's gone hunting. That gives us some time. During this time, we need to act quickly. And what we're going to do is I am going to prepare this meal as he has requested, and then you will go in instead of Esau, pretending to be Esau, and you will receive the blessing instead of him. Jacob is concerned, but what's interesting is the basis of Jacob's concern. Jacob's concern is not, no, this is deceptive. Jacob's concern is, no, I might get caught. The curse might come on me because I have deceived. I might be seen as a deceiver. And I might be cursed by my father rather than blessed. And his main concern is, Esau is a hairy man and he is not. So the difference will be obvious to the father. And he doesn't see how that can be overcome. Rebecca's response is, rather than to fill him in on how this problem can be overcome, all she says is, may the curse be on me. Don't worry. If you get caught, I'll take the brap. I'll take the blame. And Jacob's response is, he complies. His concern has been alleviated. As long as she's willing to take the rap, then he's willing to give this thing a shot. Okay, so they carry out the plan. Jacob goes out and he gets these two kid goats. He brings them in, and from then on, Rebecca does the rest. She prepares the meal with the meat from the goats. She takes the skins from the goats, and she fashions those into something that covers his arms and covers the smooth part of his neck. I assume that's back here. So he's got, now she has taken care of the problem that Jacob isn't hairy and Esau is. That seems to indicate that Esau was very hairy. I mean, it's a little hard to imagine. And those must have been put on, those gloves must have been put on in a very clever way, such that they were not easily detectable. All of that is a little hard to imagine, but she must have done something fairly compelling. Furthermore, she doesn't stop there. She's thought about it more. She gets Esau's clothes, and she puts those on Jacob so that he will have, the clothes will feel like Esau, and they will smell like Esau. Apparently, Jacob has a different odor than Esau. Esau has an outdoorsy smell, and Jacob has a barnyard smell, I suspect. Okay, so that's what they've done. Rebecca apparently knows her husband. She knows how her husband is going to respond to this situation and how he might verify who it is that's in his presence. And she has guessed correctly. Okay, the next section, verses 18 through 29. Then he came to his father and said, "My father." And he said, "Here I am. Who are you, my son?" And Jacob said to his father, "I am Esau, your firstborn. I have done as you told me. Get up, please, sit and eat of my game, that you may bless me." And Isaac said to his son, "How is it that you have it so quickly, my son?" And he said, "Because the Lord your God caused it to happen to me." Then Isaac said to Jacob, "Please come close that I may feel you, my son, whether you are really my son Esau or not." So Jacob came close to Isaac his father, and he felt him and said, "The voice is the voice of Jacob, but the hands are the hands of Esau." And he did not recognize him because his hands were hairy like his brother Esau's hands. So he blessed him. And he said, "Are you really my son Esau?" And he said, "I am." So he said, "Bring it to me, and I will eat of my son's game, that I may bless you." And he brought it to him, and he ate. He also brought him wine, and he drank. Then his father Isaac said to him, "Please come close and kiss me, my son." So he came close and kissed him. And when he smelled the smell of his garments, he blessed him and said, "See, the smell of my son is like the smell of a field which the Lord has blessed. Now may God give you of the dew of heaven and of the fatness of the earth and an abundance of grain and new wine. May peoples serve you and nations bow down to you. Be master of your brothers, and may your mother's sons bow down to you. Cursed be those who curse you, and blessed be those who bless you." Okay, so Jacob comes in with the food, and he asks Isaac to get up and eat this and bless him. Isaac is suspicious right from the beginning. He says, "Who is it?" And he says, and Jacob tells his first lie. He says, "It is Esau. It is your son Esau." And then Isaac continues to be suspicious, and he says, "How did you get it so quickly?" And Jacob's response is basically, the Lord was favorable towards me. How's he say it? "Because the Lord your God caused it to happen to me." It's interesting because I think all he's saying is, "I got lucky," in a sense. But there is another sense in which I think the author has picked up on that, the author is seeing God's hands behind this whole episode and what's happening. Then he has him come closer, and he feels him, and he feels the hairy arms. But he continues to be suspicious. He says, but the voice is the voice of Jacob. The arms are the arms of Esau, but the voice is the voice of Jacob. So every test that Isaac runs, it's not definitive. There's still question in his mind as to who this is. So he asks him again. He says, is it really you? And Jacob once again very boldly lies and says, It's Esau. It's me. It's Esau. If I put myself in Jacob's position, I mean, from the very beginning, as soon as he says, who is it? My heart would start pounding a little faster. And with each step, he's just going in deeper and deeper. It seems to me, the second time he's asked, is it Esau? And he lies and says, yes, it's Esau. Seems to me that takes a considerable amount of boldness. I worked with juvenile delinquents for a year in a camp. And one of the things that was striking to me is how good some of them were at lying. You could tell the ones that were used to lying from the ones that were not used to lying, because the ones that were used to it were really good, and the ones that weren't as used to it were not as good. And there's something about lying frequently, developing that as a habit, that makes it easier. Your conscience is quieted, and you're able to still it and proceed. And the sense I get here is that Jacob is one of those who has, to a certain extent, been able to learn the art of stilling his conscience, and he's able to very, very boldly proceed when nervousness should overcome him, I suspect. In any case, he says, it's Esau. He takes the dish to Isaac, and Isaac eats it. And apparently he can't tell the difference between goats raised in the barnyard and game at this point. Even though what he wanted was game meat, he can't tell the difference. Too old, apparently. And then the final test, he has Jacob come close, and he smells him. And now Isaac feels confident. Yes, this must be Esau. I've had my doubts along the line, but everything seems to add up. This must be Esau. What's interesting here is Isaac has ended up using all five of his senses. He has heard, he has felt, he has tasted, he has smelled, he can't see. He hasn't used that very well. But he's used all of his senses, and that's the way that he has decided to determine whether this is Esau or not. Interesting. That's very interesting, because if you remember back when I was talking about Jacob's deception of how he conned Esau out of the birthright, that the narrative goes out of its way to depict Esau in a way that is animal-like. He doesn't think in the long term. He thinks in terms of satisfying his immediate desires rather than putting things into the long-term perspective. That was the problem with Esau. That's what got him into trouble. Well, Isaac is acting a bit animal-like here, relying upon his sensual data to determine who his son is. I mean, think about it. What if you were in the same situation? Would it not make more sense to ask Jacob some questions? Ask him some questions about hunting. Those are questions that Esau is going to be able to answer correctly, and Jacob is not going to be able to answer. And questions that Isaac knows the right answer to. I mean, ask him about some traits of animals, wild animals. What do they do when this happens? Where do you aim your bow shot when the animal's so far away, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, I don't even know what questions to ask. But Isaac would know. Why doesn't he do that? Or some shared experiences that only he and Esau have had out hunting or something. Jacob wouldn't know that. But he doesn't use that avenue of questioning. He's depending on sensual data. I was thinking there would be another approach that he could take as well. He could ask him, how do you want to be blessed? Because that would be asking him, what do you value most? Presumably, there would be differences in how they would answer. And Jacob isn't going to feign the values of Esau because he's going to get stuck with whatever he asks for. Esau might say, give me success in the hunt. Jacob doesn't want that. Jacob doesn't want to hunt. That would be a way of exploring what their values are. And Isaac doesn't go that route either. Isaac has gone the route of trusting his sensual data. And I think that we are intended to understand that there is a likeness here between Isaac and Esau. They are both very sensual. There's a sense in which they are, in that respect, animal-like. And that's part of the bond that holds them together. And just as that got Esau into trouble, that is getting Isaac into trouble. In any case, Isaac is fooled. Isaac is confident enough that he goes ahead and gives the blessing. And the blessing consists of asking for some things that are critical for his prosperity. That is, dew in a land that is parched, the abundance of crops, and in particular, abundance of grain and abundance of new wine. So that's one part of the blessing. The other part of the blessing is that you may be superior to those who are around you. And notice how he words that, and that's in verse 29. May peoples serve you, and nations bow down to you. Be master of your brothers, and may your mother's sons bow down to you. It seems to me that's a very pointed counter to the prophecy that was made, because the prophecy said, and one people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger. So I think what's happening here is Isaac wants to countermand, for some justification, he wants Esau to get the blessing that has been prophesied to go to Jacob. And quite pointedly so. Okay. And then may those who hate you be cursed and those who love you be blessed. That was the blessing that was given to Abraham initially. Then that was given to Isaac. And he wants to now extend that to Esau. Okay, the next section. Here's where Isaac finds out what has happened. Verse 30. Now it came about, as soon as Isaac had finished blessing Jacob, and Jacob had hardly gone out from the presence of Isaac his father, that Esau his brother came in from his hunting. Then he also made savory food and brought it to his father. And he said to his father, Let my father arise and eat of his son's game, that you may bless me. And Isaac his father said to him, Who are you? And he said, I am your son, your firstborn, Esau. Then Isaac trembled violently and said, Who was he then that hunted game and brought it to me, so that I ate of all of it before you came and blessed him? Yes, and he shall be blessed. When Esau heard the words of his father, he cried out with an exceedingly great and bitter cry, and said to his father, Bless me, even me also, O my father. And he said, Your brother came deceitfully and has taken away your blessing. Then he said, Is he not rightly named Jacob? For he has supplanted me these two times. He took away my birthright, and behold, now he has taken away my blessing. And he said, Have you not reserved a blessing for me? But Isaac answered and said to Esau, Behold, I have made him your master, and all his relatives I have given to him as servants. And with grain and new wine I have sustained him. Now as for you then, what can I do, my son? And Esau said to his father, Do you have only one blessing, my father? Bless me, even me also, my father. So Esau lifted his voice and wept. Then Isaac his father answered and said to him, Behold, away from the fertility of the earth shall be your dwelling, and away from the dew of the heaven from above. And by your sword you shall live, and your brother you shall serve. But it shall come about, when you shall become restless, that you shall break his yoke from your neck. Okay, stop there. Okay, so Esau now comes in, and it's shortly after Jacob has left. The narrator points that out, and that's significant because this scheme could have easily failed. This scheme just barely succeeded. And one has to ask the question, why did it succeed? I mean, it was a very risky scheme in the first place. But it succeeds, but only barely. Esau comes in. He invites his father to eat. And Isaac says, Who are you? And Esau says, Well, I mean, Esau doesn't know what's happened. Esau says, It's your firstborn. It's Esau, of course. I mean, you asked me to go out and get the meal, didn't you? And bring it back in. And Isaac's response is that he shook violently, is that what it says? Or shook terribly? Isaac trembled violently and says, Who was he then that hunted game and brought it to me? Why does he shake? Why does he tremble violently? The only way I can piece this together is Isaac was nervous to start with. He knew that he was doing something that was contrary to what God had prophesied. And now he realizes that God has so worked things out that even Isaac's attempts to go counter to God's prophecy have failed. God has done what he had said that he would do, and he brought this blessing upon Jacob, contrary to Isaac's wishes. So I think what we have here is Isaac, at first, he's kind of angry and probably a bit fearful, but quickly realizes what has happened. God's hands are in all of this, and there's nothing that Isaac can do to go counter to what God has decided that he will do. And Isaac very quickly resigns himself to that. And I think that's why he can say, after he explains what has happened, he says, yes, and he shall be blessed. That Isaac is realizing God is going to do this. God brought this blessing about on Jacob, and he will carry that out. And it is futile for me to think otherwise or try to work things otherwise. Okay. Esau then is outraged. And you can imagine his outrage. I mean, it's justified. He's been robbed. And this is the second time that he's been robbed. And it happened through deceitful means. So Esau complains and says that he has been cheated and Jacob has deceived his father and brought this about. So Esau asks for another blessing. Now it's interesting, the blessing that Isaac gave to Jacob, part of it was abundance. Why couldn't he give abundance to Esau as well? I mean, is God only capable of one abundance per person to anyone? Is there only one abundance to go around? I think the reason he can't give abundance to Esau is not that he couldn't proclaim those words again, but that he understands that God is carrying out the prophecy that he had given when the children were still in the womb. It's not that he couldn't say those words, but he understands that those words would have no power and it would be pointless. God has already determined how he is going to treat the two twins, and he's going to treat them very differently. He understands that Esau is not destined to be blessed with abundance. So, he proclaims a blessing on Esau that is the best that he can do, one that is in keeping with God's wishes, and that is, Esau is going to live away from where the dew is. Esau is going to live where the ground does not yield up abundant crops. He is going to be a fighter. He's going to be a struggler all of his life, and he will not live in peace. And he will serve his brother, just as had been prophesied. But at the end of it, there is the one hint of hope, the kind of the best blessing that can come out of this. And that is, but it shall come about when you become restless, that you shall break his yoke from your neck. So the servitude that he has to give, yield up to Jacob, will come to an end. And his nation will be freed from the control of Jacob's nation at some point in time. So that's apparently the most blessing that Isaac could give and still stay within the parameters of what God had wanted from the very begining. Okay, 41 through 46. So Esau bore a grudge against Jacob because of the blessing with which his father had blessed him. And Esau said to himself, "The days of mourning for my father are near. Then I will kill my brother Jacob." Now when the words of her elder son Esau were reported to Rebekah, she sent and called her younger son Jacob and said to him, "Behold, your brother Esau is consoling himself concerning you by planning to kill you. Now, therefore, my son, obey my voice and arise. Flee to Haran, to my brother Laban, and stay with him a few days until your brother's fury subsides, until your brother's anger against you subsides, and he forgets what you did to him. Then I shall send and get you from there. Why should I be bereaved of you both in one day?" It's not clear whether Rebekah had foreseen this kind of response on the part of Esau or not. I suspect that she didn't. because we see her scrambling here to come up with a plan to deal with this. But she may have. In any case, Esau's response is kind of what we would have expected. Esau is a violent man. He's a man of action, and he's a man who responds to his immediate desires without a lot of forethought. And here his response is, I'm going to kill him. As soon as my father dies, I'm going to kill him. So Rebecca, she's got another plan. I mean, she's a woman with a plan. She's got another plan. This time, it's to send Jacob off to her brother Laban. Just for a few days, mind you. He just needs to go for a few days till Esau cools down, and then he could come back. But that's the plan that she's going to work on. So and the reason that she gives, her main concern is she doesn't want the last sentence of this section. Why should I be bereaved of you both in one day? I think the both is Isaac and Jacob. Because in the day that Isaac dies, then Esau is saying he will kill Jacob, indicating that she would lose the two who are closest to her in one day, and she couldn't bear to see that happen. So she sends Jacob off. She's doing is complaining about the women, the local women. They are not suitable wives for their son. Remember that both Isaac and Rebekah had been upset by the wives that Esau had married. They were local wives. And she's saying they are not local wives, they're just problems. We've had problems with our in-laws already. We don't want Jacob to marry local ones. Let's send him back to Laban. So here she is carrying out further, laying the groundwork to carry out this scheme that she has come up with to save her son Jacob from Esau. Okay. How should we think about the four people involved in this scenario? Isaac clearly, his favorite is Esau. He much prefers Esau to Jacob. And he would like to be able to make Esau his heir. I think he'd like Esau to get the birthright. He'd like Esau to get the blessing. But he's already missed out on the birthright. And Isaac is thinking, I want to make sure that Esau gets the blessing. Esau's the firstborn, and Esau is Isaac's favorite. Clearly, he would have seen Esau's flaws. Jacob and Esau are about 77 years old at this point. Clearly, Isaac has seen that Esau is not perfect. He's got flaws. But he's also seen Jacob for 77 years, and Jacob is no angel. There's not a clear choice between the two. It's not clear that one of them is vastly superior to the other. They've both got significant character flaws. So his choice would be that Esau, his favorite, be the one who inherits the blessing. But that would be in direct defiance. That'd be directly against the prophecy. So is Isaac determined to work against God's will? My guess is that, I mean, it's hard for me to believe that this Isaac, who had gone up to the top of Mount Moriah and had been on the altar when God asked Abraham to kill his son, that same Isaac would directly go against the will of God. I think that in that whole scenario, Isaac was willing to be put to death. So would Isaac go directly against God's will here? My guess is that there's some rationalization going on, that the prophecy isn't clear, or God may have changed his mind. I'm not sure what Isaac is thinking. But however Isaac has rationalized it, he thinks that there is a chance that the blessing can go to Esau rather than to Jacob. And he wants to do everything that he can to make that happen. But clearly, he's not completely at ease with that decision and that course of action. And as a result, as he's going about doing this blessing, he makes it a private affair. And he's nervous about it. And so when he's caught, when he discovers that he has already given the blessing to Jacob, he realizes God is at work. God is making sure that things work according to his prophecy, that his attempts to overturn that have been frustrated. And then Isaac, he recognizes that and he gives up. He acquiesces to God and God's plan. Interestingly, there's no hint that Isaac has any anger towards either Jacob or Rebekah. And I think that's because Isaac has come to terms with this. He realizes that God's fingerprints are all over what's happening. What do we think about Esau? There's a sense in which you have to feel sorry for him. He's an innocent victim on the one hand. But, interestingly, his response to the whole scenario is very telling of his character. He is a violent man who is ruled by his passions. And his response is, I'm going to kill that guy. I'm going to kill Jacob. That's interesting because later in Genesis, we see another person wronged by his brothers. That is, Joseph is sold into slavery by his brothers. And yet Joseph is able to come to terms with that and forgive them completely. Esau's initial response here is, I'm going to kill him. That's a very different response. However, we will see in the next few weeks as we proceed that Esau too comes to the place where he forgives Jacob for what he has done. But his initial response is very characteristic of Esau in his first 77 years of life. Rebekah is a deceiver and a manipulator. I mean, that's all we see of her really here. She was the mastermind. She was the one who was calling all the shots. And Jacob was just doing her bidding. Jacob is a deceiver and a manipulator himself. He's obviously had a very good teacher, and he has learned that from his mother. And we'll notice that it kind of runs in the family. Laban also is a deceiver. So that whole family is characterized by deception. But I think that in this situation, Rebekah feels justified in what she's doing because she's remembering back to the prophecy, and all she's doing is making sure that things worked out according to what God had prophesied. And as a result, she feels justified in what she's doing. There's a certain amount of self-righteousness behind this. But in trying to help God out, she has created an enormous amount of animosity between Esau and her and Jacob. And that's much to her discredit, I think. How about Jacob? Well, by going along, Jacob has created a mess. Esau hates him. And because Esau hates him, he has to leave the land that's been given to his descendants. He has to leave, and he ends up being gone for a long time. It's not a few days. It turns out to be years. He, too, is a deceiver. But as we will see, he ends up being the recipient of deception. He is one who is deceived later on. And he's one who has much to learn. He has much to learn about himself, and he has much to learn about God. But God begins now, we'll see in the next, starting in the next chapter, God begins this process of taking Jacob from one who manipulates and connives to get his own way to one who eventually comes to have trust in God. It's not an easy route, but it's one that God is successfully capable of taking him through. If we look at the epitaphs for each of the first three patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, it's kind of interesting to see how they're stated. It says that Abraham died in a ripe old age, an old man satisfied with life. That sounds like someone who has lived life well. Isaac, it says in chapter 32, verse 29, he died an old man of ripe age. There's a significant omission there from the one that was proclaimed on Abraham. It doesn't say satisfied with life. Then with respect to Jacob, there isn't the exact same formula used, but later at the end of Jacob's life, they're in Egypt and the Pharaoh comes to Jacob and asks him how old he is. And Jacob responds and says, "Few and unpleasant have been the years of my life." So it's interesting that we have Jacob depicted as one who lives a full life and lives it well. Isaac lives a full life, and Jacob lives a short life, relatively speaking. A short life, and the years have been unpleasant. So I think that we are to see these as kind of a degeneration that occurs from one generation to the next in the quality of their lives. Okay, what are we to make of this section? It seems to me that what it's depicting here is two different kinds of faithlessness. One kind of faithlessness fights against the will of God. It will be my way, not your way. I am determined that things will turn out to my liking, even if that is contrary to what God wants. That's a kind of defiant faithlessness. But there can be another faithlessness as well, and that is God can't bring about his will without my help. I have to step in here and fix things where they've gone awry and make sure that they turn out the way that God has wanted it to be. And there's a sense then that the goodness of the end or the cause justifies then whatever steps I take to make sure that that happens. And I think that what we're meant to see here is that God gives us principles by which we are to live our lives, guidelines within which we live our lives. And we go about living our lives in an attempt to be obedient towards God and let the outcome of those actions be up to God. He's perfectly capable of bringing about his will, of making sure that his will is done. We play a role in that, certainly, but we ought not elevate our role too greatly. It's only a little role. When it comes down to it, we just play a bit part in bringing about God's will. He's the one that does the heavy lifting. And if we ever get that out of perspective, there's a sense in which that's faithlessness. We've elevated ourselves to a position that is not ours. God can do his thing. So there's a certain amount of disinterestedness that we ought to have towards God's will being brought into being. God can do that himself. He doesn't need our help. I will use there's an example that comes to mind. I can't help but have it come to mind. Excuse me for using this example, but this is what I'm going to use. I really do think that Gutenberg College is a good thing. I think that God wants Gutenberg College to survive and thrive. But what is my responsibility with respect to Gutenberg College? What do I do? And I think the answer is, I do those things that I can do to further Gutenberg College's health that are within the guidelines that God has laid down for me. I act responsibly. I do what makes sense, what seems to be wise. But I don't do anything that is outside of the guidelines that God has laid down. Because the minute I do, then I'm taking the perspective that God needs my help to make sure that this happens. And that's wrong, because God does not need my help. I'm just playing a bit part, and it's a teeny bit part. But when it comes right down to it, God is the one who will determine whether that happens and whether it will not, and he does not need my help. God has just been gracious to me to give me a bit part, and my job is to play that bit role faithfully. So there are two kinds of faithlessness. One is obvious, the other one is less obvious, but they are both faithlessness, nevertheless. They are both ways of usurping God's authority and taking on ourselves a role that has not been given to us. That's reserved for God alone. Okay. Any questions or comments?
Whenever I reread this, I'm thinking about there must have been a breakdown between the relationship between Jacob and, Rebecca. And that,
between Jacob and Rebecca.
Hold it, am I getting this right? Well, I'm sorry. Isaac and Rebecca, I apologize. And that it was expressed by this favoritism.
Yeah.
That was one of the symptoms of the separation. And it, one that, how can I say, because of this, is like, okay, this is your son, this is my son. And I think I didn't realize how strong that was until you was reading through the blessing before you got to it. It just struck me like, your mother's sons.
Yes. Yes.
And...
yeah, I suspect there's a certain amount of tension there. They both have a favorite, and so that clearly is going to create a certain amount of tension. What is striking to me, however, is, especially after this happens, there's no indication in the text that there is a rift that develops between Isaac and Rebekah. Nor is there an indication of a rift between Isaac and Jacob. And in the absence of some indication of that, I'm inclined to think that Isaac has really resigned himself to what has happened. And he's saying, they may have been deceptive and they may have done something that's wrong, But God was working his will through that. And I'm not going to hold that against them. Let God hold that against them. I'm not going to hold that against them. And that reminds me of one of my favorite verses in Genesis, when Joseph's brothers, after Jacob dies, Joseph's brothers are afraid now Joseph's going to get back at us. And Joseph is really grieved by that. Don't they realize that I have truly forgiven them? I mean, they still think that this has been an act, and I've just been waiting for my chance to get vengeance on them. And his line there is, to his brothers, he says, and this is his realization that he's come to over the years. He says, "You meant it for evil, but God meant it for good." And the wonderful thing about that verse is it captures their responsibility. They really intended to do him wrong. And he realizes that. He's not downplaying that. But on the other hand, God was working through that to affect his purposes. And he acknowledges that. My assumption is that Isaac is seeing it the same way. They deceived me. They did wrong. But I'm not going to hold it against them, because God was working out his purposes through that. Let them stand before God for what they've done that's wrong. I'm not going to hold it against them. I forgive them. So I assume that's what's happening.
It seems almost superstitious that Isaac would assume that whoever was in this room beside him was the one who would get the blessing. A thought that occurred to me was, could he not have said, wherever Isaac or wherever Esau is, this is my blessing for him? If he was truly... and I don't know if this is more based on his nature or the culture or his doubts about his own, giving the blessing or countermanding God, but that he could have just said, wherever Esau is, this is his blessing, right, even if this is not his body right in front of me.
Right, right. Yeah, I don't know the rules of how a blessing is done. I would assume that the way the blessing is done is the son is there and he lays his hand on him or something and proclaims the blessing, that that's the way that it is done. Could he have done it differently? I don't know. I don't know whether the rules allowed for that. But what's happened is, apparently he is convinced as he feels he needs to be, that the person here is indeed Esau. So he goes ahead and he gives the blessing as he would if Esau were there. What he realizes later is God's hand was in that. And rather than complaining, you weren't really Esau, so that doesn't count, rather than going that direction at all, it's just that God's doing what he had decided from the very beginning that he's going to do, and I'm not going to try to change that. I assume that's what's happening. Okay, one more, and then we'll go.
I have to get over my microphone phobia.
Me too.
I really appreciated what you said about understanding our role in our lives as far as God's will and making God's will happen. And understanding that when we elevate ourselves, that it really is a form of faithlessness. And there is someone else in the Bible that had a very clear understanding of what his role was, and I so appreciated it. I thought maybe you wouldn't mind if I just read a little bit. It's John the Baptist, and it's in John chapter 3. And it says, it's talking about his disciples came to John. And it says, they came to John and said to him, Rabbi, that man who was with you on the other side of the Jordan, the one you testified about, well, he is baptizing, and everyone is going to him. To this, John replied, a man can receive only what is given him from heaven. You yourselves can testify that I said, I am not the Christ, but am sent ahead of him. The bride belongs to the bridegroom. The friend who attends the bridegroom waits and listens for him and is full of joy when he hears the bridegroom's voice. That joy is mine, and it is now complete. He must become greater, and I must become less. I thought that's very extraordinary for a human being to recognize he must become less, because most of us spend our entire lives trying to become more.
Right. Right. That is extraordinary, and in fact, it is a gift from God. I mean, to come to that realization, a sound understanding of where we fit into reality, what role God has for us to play, and to be content with that, that is a gift from God. And that is indeed extraordinary. Okay, thanks.